From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A high-profile special election in Pennsylvania last night is still too close to call, although the Democrat, Conor Lamb, declared victory with fewer than 700 votes separating him from the Republican Rick Saccone in this bright red district that candidate Donald Trump won by 20 points. There could be a recount, but it's not mandatory.
And the day after President Trump fired his Secretary of State, we have news from the Washington Post that he will name TV commentator Larry Kudlow to be his new top economic advisor, replacing Gary Cohn. Lots to talk about with Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist who worked in the Obama White House and is the national spokeswoman for MoveOn.org, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist who worked in the George W. Bush White House and is on President Trump's White House Fellowships Commission. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi, and let's start in Pennsylvania. Here's Conor Lamb this morning on CNN.
I describe myself as a Pennsylvania Democrat, looking to get things done and especially to be for and represent working people. And so we will work with the other side if that's what it takes to bring jobs here or protect our people. And that seems to be what most people want around here.
Paris, many are describing this as a win for the Democrats, a major loss for the GOP. Do you agree with that?
I mean, the race has not been called, but, if it is that Lamb does pull out a victory, I don't think it's a major win for the Democrat Party. I think it's a win. A win is a win if that happens. But I think the real win is for the Make America Great Again agenda, for Republican principles. Listen, this was a man who ran as a Republican, essentially.
You mean Lamb?
Lamb, the Democrat, ran as a Republican. He was pro-gun, pro-life, pro-coal, and he said he was against Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former Speaker of the House. And so, but if he were an actual Republican, he would have ran on that agenda and won as a Republican. But so the message of the president and the Make America Great agenda is one that is a winning message. And he ran and won on it.
Karine, doesn't he have a point, though? Because even Lamb said, I only represent me. I don't represent the party. And he did. He was like Seth Moulton, Senator Seth Moulton, his advisor. Congressman Seth Moulton, who advised him. They're both Marines, both vets. Very much anti-Nancy Pelosi. So isn't this also something that reveals a fracture in your party?
No, I don't. I totally disagree with my friend Paris here. I mean, look, so what Paris is saying is that the Republicans didn't put a good enough candidate in PA 18 to win a district that is ruby red. Trump, as you mentioned, Robin, won it by 20 points, and it's been a Republican seat for almost two decades. I mean, that just is ridiculous to say that talking points coming from Republicans is ridiculous. Look, at the end of the day, Lamb opposed Trump's agenda. He opposed the tax plan. He promised that he would fight if Republicans tried to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. He was for unions. He is for unions. And so I think that makes him one of those Democrats that we want in our party.
He's certainly not progressive or in the liberal vein of where I think the National Democratic Party is, and I think that's telling for candidates who want to run in the future moving into 2018.
But the thing about that, Paris, is what is the thing that progressive, one of the big issues that progressive fought for was making sure that Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security stayed intact last year. That was protecting health care, making sure Obamacare wasn't repealed. That was a major progressive issue. That was a major part of kind of the big fight, one of the big fights of the Democratic Party last year. And he stands with us on that. He said he would fight Paul Ryan and everyone else who tries to take that away.
Just not Nancy Pelosi.
Okay.
But that's not a litmus test. That is not a litmus test on how progressive he is. That is an individual decision.
I was watching a TV broadcast last night with some of the voters from the district in Pennsylvania. And one woman asked the reporter, did you see the news this morning? He fired somebody else. And she was talking about Rex Tillerson. Another one. I just can't take this anymore, she said. Paris, what a week of turmoil in the White House. We had the firing of the Secretary of State. And now Larry Kudlow, the TV commentator, is going to be his new top economic advisor. Is the White House in chaos, as we've asked many times before?
Well, you can look at him as firing people. I like to look at him as hiring better candidates. And so he's hired the former CIA director, and he's hired the first woman to be head of the CIA. And I think that when you look at Larry Kudlow, I mean, there's more to him than just being a TV commentator. He's well respected in the financial and economic spaces of the arena. And so I don't think it's turmoil. Look, when President Obama was in office, people talked about him and the team of rivals and having great debates and fracturing opinions and all these things. And they said that was smart. That was genius. That was a good thing to do. President Trump likes to have people that disagree with him, and he goes back and forth on policy.
Well, wait a minute.
And they say that's chaos.
But wait, Paris, he fires the people who disagree mm-hmm. with him.
He fires the people who do not agree with his agenda. Look, when you are working for the president of the United States, it's not your agenda. And this is what Lamb has to realize when he gets to Congress. It's not his own. You fall in line with what the leadership wants you to do. And the leader in this case is the president. So if you are at odds with his policies that you are supposed to enact as a secretary of state, it's best that you either resign or get fired and have someone who will be close to his vision, match his vision for how to make America great again, but also put America first.
Korean?
And when you go into Korea, North Korea and Syria and all these other issues, he has to have somebody that is 100% behind him and supporting the agenda.
So I have to say, Robin, Donald Trump is the only person that can make a former CEO of Exxon a sympathetic figure. Yeah. I think it's just the craziest thing. Look, before Donald Trump started firing people, before people started leaving him, he said he would hire the best people. What happened to that? Everybody that he's hired in all of these cabinet positions are not qualified to hold the position that they were hired to do. And here's the thing, you know, Donald Trump is clearly off the rails, as this the person that was being spoken to and said that, oh, he fired another person. There's chaos upon chaos. And anytime people try to put guardrails around him, they get fired. And he doesn't want anybody who is not a yes person. That's what he wants. That is the only thing that Donald Trump can understand.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. I want to ask, though, but you say no chaos, but and Paris, you say, you know, people who agree with him. But now we have, you know, Rex Tillerson was the one who wanted to have talks with Korea. The president, you know, finally said, yes, I'm going to have talks without telling Rex Tillerson. And now he's appointed as Secretary of State, somebody who's much warier, somebody who's, you know, much warier of talks. So where, just take that, Paris. Where do you see talks with North Korea going?
I think that if they happen, the president will be leading this effort. He is a good negotiator, and he is going to do the best and get the best deal for the American people and more so for the world. But if Mike Pompeo did not agree with the president's strategy and his engagement efforts with North Korea, he would not have accepted the role as Secretary of State. And he well understands that by accepting it, he has got to be 100% behind the president's engagement strategy, maximum pressure on North Korea. He would not have accepted if otherwise.
Today, as we're talking to you, students across the country walked out of school in honor of the 17 Parkland, Florida victims killed last month. Here are some students chanting in front of Brooklyn Tech in New York City.
No more silence!
No more silence!
And gun violence!
And gun violence!
Now, Republican Senate leaders and the NRA back a bill to require better federal agency reporting on mental health to the background check system. But this week, President Trump seemed to backtrack on raising the age limit to buy a gun when it was left out of his school safety recommendations. Corrine, are lawmakers going to disappoint these student activists?
It seems like it, at least on the federal level. I mean, the walkouts are inspiring. We need them, and I'm glad that they're doing it. And these students have been amazing this past month, and I appreciate and applaud their voice. And they are the leaders. They are the ones, if anything's going to change on this issue, they're going to be the ones that are going to make it happen. And they said it, too. If you heard some of the interviews from students who were out across the country when they were asked, you know, if this doesn't happen, what will you do? And they said, hey, look, we're 17, 18 years old. We're going to be voting. Some of us are going to be voting in November. And so we will vote these guys out. And so I think they're pretty serious. And that's the action that's going to happen if things don't happen on the federal level.
Well, and we were going to have a conversation with those who survived the Sutherland church shooting. We remember that in Texas.
Yep.
And many of them feel the exact opposite. You know, they still want to be able to have their their guns to protect themselves. So we're going to keep on that. But, Paris, I want to ask you about a report that we just found confounding in some ways. It was in today's New York Times that the Trump administration wants to get rid of Obama-era guidance for schools that was intended to rein in excessive suspensions and expulsions of minority kids. Now, it is a fact that black kids are disproportionately arrested in schools for things that white kids are merely slapped on the wrist for. And the president wants to roll that back. But he said this in the name of preventing school shootings. Now, no black student has ever been a mass shooter in a school. It was sort of, somehow throwing this, at young black kids who have problems of their own in the inner city. Were you troubled by that?
Well, this is the first time I'm actually hearing about that. And so I, instead of commenting on something that I don't know
fully
front page. About.
Yeah, take a look at it. I'd be curious.
Yeah, I'll tweet about it and give you my opinion. But what I do know is that this president is one who is listening to the American people, listening to the survivors and school educators and professionals to make the best decision. His policy that he put out first was something that he thought he could do immediately. And he's going to turn to the Congress to do something that they can do long term.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Paris Denard, Republican strategist, and Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist. Thanks as always.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Generations of parents have lost a guide and touchstone, pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton, who died yesterday at the age of 99. Through his Touchpoints book series, his Emmy-winning television show, What Every Baby Knows, and his practice, he changed the way we think about babies, exploring their emotional as well as their physical well-being, and he'd address their parents' well-being as well. He developed the Neonatal Behavioral Assessment Scale to test newborns' responsiveness to sound and light. It came to be known as the Brazelton. He was known as the baby whisperer. And for one lucky neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts, he was Mr. Rogers. That's where we spoke with him in 2005. Dr. Brazelton had just published Sibling Rivalry and Managing Your Anger with his co-author and longtime colleague, Dr. Joshua Sparrow. The book maintains that most anger and aggression in little ones is as bewildering to them as it is to their parents.
I think that's what it is, that they're out of control and they know it, and it scares them.
It could be you give one example of a little boy might be in an entranceway to a room. He just doesn't know which direction to go in, and he can fall apart.
And that's exactly what they do. They're really trying to come to the point of being in control themselves rather than taking it from us. And so if parents can see that as a big step in their emotional development and their cognitive development and their motor development, then it isn't such a threat anymore.
You have a lot of ways that parents can deal with children's anger and aggression, starting with, swaddling an infant so that it's a flailing arm doesn't frighten the infant. Mm-hmm. But on up to the older children, and I want to run through some of those because parents might be hearing you and hearing a laughter in your voice and saying, but I'm desperate when this happens. What happens when it's older children and a child is out of control in a tantrum?
Well, that terrible thing that happened in Florida, the child being handcuffed mm-hmm. for having an aggression, a period of out of control, that five-year-old was crying for help.
Teachers there said they had tried everything, and this child was disrupting the class. You say there's a physical way even to approach a child who is in this case. What are some of the things a parent can do?
Well, you can just pick up a child five and hold it. And hold it tight. And if it's going to bang her head or kick you or whatever, you can get a hold on them that keeps them from hurting you.
You suggest sitting a child in your lap facing away from you mm-hmm. with your arms around their front and then maybe gently putting a leg over their legs if
their
you need
legs.
To.
And safety is the first step. And then when you've got them safe, say, now calm down, calm down, calm down, and don't get excited because that just adds to their excitement. Once they've calmed down, say, now let's talk about it. What was it? And then listen. And once you listen, then you have some idea of what triggered this, and you can begin to try to explain it to the child who wants to know themselves, and you can explain it to yourself. And then at the end of it, say, every time you do this, I'll have to control you until you can control yourself. And that's the acme. That's when you've really made it, when they can control themselves.
What do you do if you suspect?
It's more serious. Yeah, I think when the parent feels they're out of control too, and they don't know what to do about that child, it's time to turn to somebody else. And it doesn't need to be a psychiatrist. It can be somebody who can put their finger on what's behind it. But I don't think you can just throw a child away when they're in trouble like that. I think the main thing is your own, as a parent, your own feelings.
In fact, you write about ghosts from the nursery. That many times it may not be the child that needs the help. The child's reflecting a serious problem in the parent.
Yeah, I think every child calls up the ghosts from your own nursery. And when they hit on something that's very sensitive, you know, you don't have a lot of control over that. One of my grandchildren said to his mother, who's a lot like me, he was six at this point, "Mommy, we'll do better when you calm down." You know, he was right on target, because once she calmed down, this made her laugh, and then she calmed down and things went just swimmingly.
What else might, though, be reflected? I mean, give me some more examples of when a parent might pull themselves up short and say, "Wait a minute, this child is triggering something in me."
Well, I went to the grocery store the other day, and this woman was whamming away at her two-year-old, you know, banging on him because he pulled things off the shelf. So I went over, and so I said to her, "Isn't it awful to bring a two-year-old to the grocery store?" And she sat down and started weeping and wept. And at that point, this two-year-old climbed up in her lap and patted her face. And so I said to her, "You know, this really gets to you, doesn't it?" And she said, "Oh, my mother used to just tie me up in knots when she'd go to the grocery store, because if she didn't tie me up, I'd be pulling everything off." I said, "You realize what you're bringing from your own past?" And she said, "I never thought of it before."
You know, I'm also thinking it must have been, this woman looks up and there's T. Barry Preselton telling her what to do with her child. But so what does that mother do now?
Well, I think there are a lot of things she could do. One is not bring the child to the grocery store. But the other is, if she does, put him in the cart. You know, the grocery stores have figured this out. You put him in the cart and keep him there. And the third thing is that if it isn't working, gather that child up in your arms and take him out to the car and sit there with him. Say, "Now, when you're ready, we'll go back. But until you can get ready, we can't be there."
How do you navigate, well, even as a pediatrician, when you can see that a child may be acting out or angry, and then there's a real problem with the parent, alcoholism or something that a parent is not likely to see?
I think when the child is sad, when they don't respond with excitement about learning something new, then you look behind that, trying to help these people, not criticizing them, but saying, "Look, things aren't going right, are they? Can't I help?" And then listen. And people are willing to tell you.
This is T. Barry Brazelton speaking to us in 2005 about a range of things: having remote parents who liked his brother better, his regret that his work took him from his own children, sibling rivalry. He says, "Tell siblings to work things out." I said, "Some tried that." How long do you wait to see if they can?
Well, I was 50 before I liked my brother. So I can't promise any cutoff point.
You also raise in your book, Understanding Sibling Rivalry, the thing parents don't like to talk about. What if the kids are reflecting a parent's feeling and the parent honestly has to confront the feeling maybe they do like a child better than another child?
Well,
by the way, I don't want any children listening at this point.
You're wonderful. I think confronting those feelings makes them not so strong. The second you have a bias, if you bring it to the surface, it doesn't operate any longer.
It sounds like you're saying that you've sacrificed, you know, some sort of connection with your own children because of what you've given to other children. So given that, What do you want that legacy to be, you know, even, you know, given especially that you made some sacrifices for it?
I guess I really want to see parents and children as our first priority in this country, and they're probably our bottom priority at present. It's just so discouraging to see what we're doing to children. you know, testing four-year-olds. It's just absurd. I think things have just gone so crazy in the past few years that it scares me.
8 years later, in 2013, we met a more reflective T. Barry Brazelton, if that's possible. At 95, he'd just written the memoir Learning to Listen, A Life Caring for Children. And as we looked at the coming end of his career, we talked about when it started, when he first entered the profession, well over a half century ago.
People were just sort of run through like they were on a conveyor belt. But I went into pediatrics because I love kids. I wanted to get inside their brains. I very quickly realized that I couldn't do it unless I understood what their parents saw in them. So I began to try to like parents. And since I'd had a mother that liked my brother but not me, that's one of the ghosts.
Right.
I had a hard time liking parents, but when I finally did, I found that they could tell me so much. And I found out that even in the first two or three months, a child used his behavior as his language.
Why do you love babies so much?
I don't know. I just always have. I was in Croatia after that nightmare over there, and this psychologist who was working with all these children who'd watched their parents raped and murdered and hung came and said, "I'm so depressed, Dr. B. How in the world do you keep yourself from burning out?" And I thought about it. I said, "I don't know why. I never thought about burning out." Then I said, "Yes, I do. I go and play with a newborn baby, and I see how exciting a baby can be and what that baby can tell us about himself, and he'll lead us right out of our burnout."
The late pediatrician and child-rearing expert T. Barry Brazelton in 2013 at 95. He was born in Waco, Texas. I love how he still says Churin. He died yesterday at 99 after 30 books and millions of grateful parents. Another tip he gave us for doctors interacting with parents is to always compliment them first. You know, "I love how you're doing this. I love how you're doing this with your kids." And then ask, "How can I help you?" To hear our entire interviews with Dr. Brazelton or for more information about his work, go to hearandnow.org.
United is apologizing for what it calls a tragic accident after a French bulldog died on a flight from Houston to New York's LaGuardia. A flight attendant reportedly told the dog's owner that the animal had to be kept in a closed overhead bin. When the flight landed, the dog had died, and now United is facing yet another PR nightmare. Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, it's a terrible story. This dog was named Coquito and was traveling with a mother and her two children. What happened?
Oh, this one really hit a nerve with everyone, didn't it, Jeremy? We're all talking about it today. It's just it's like another one of these nightmares around flying, and a lot of it is all the stress and the certainly miscommunication. I mean, from adding to what you just described, you know, the dog was in a pet carrier, you know, those bags that, you know, have mesh on them.
Right.
It was blocking the aisle, and from the reports of other passengers, it appeared that, you know, the flight attendant thought it was in the way and asked her to put it up. The woman says she told her it was a dog. The flight attendant apparently didn't hear that, or now says she didn't realize the dog was in there. And then 3 hours later, they land. The mother was taking care of the baby. She had an infant with her. So, you know, there was some noise initially, but no one really did anything or checked or probably had their seatbelts on. And then they land and this dog unfortunately died. United, which you said, you know, has said it's a tragic accident. They're expressing their deepest condolences. They've also said they'll pay for the autopsy to find out exactly how the dog died. So,
you know, and this comes also after a lot of news about airlines trying to cut back on people bringing these emotional support animals on board. What do the regulations say about bringing dogs on?
This this is where it's another. There are no set rules, right? It's up to every airline to make the rule. There's no one uniform policy, and this is really an industry that is struggling to keep up. There's been an explosion in these numbers. I mean, way more people are bringing pets and also support service animals on board. All types of animals, by the way, not just dogs. And you know, we had that there was that famous story in the headlines, and it was involving United, where the woman tried to bring a peacock onto a cabin. So, you know, it seems like each handles it differently, and maybe there's some discretion with the flight crew. They're not sure what to do. You know, you're in that. You're trying to get out the gate, keep the flight on time. It just sounds like it's a terribly stressful situation for everybody, the pet owners, the fellow passengers. Maybe some may be allergic, maybe scared. There was a man bit on one by someone in the middle seat. Plane crews don't seem to know how to handle this. So I think this is just really underscores the need for the industry to get together and have one set of rules that applies to everyone so all the passengers know what to do. And clearly we're not there yet.
And what does this mean for United? You know, as we're talking about this story, we now hear that they're investigating how they mistakenly flew one family's German Shepherd to Japan instead of Kansas City. I mean, what does this mean for them?
Which, by the way, I think it was a 10-year-old German Shepherd, right? It's a horribly long flight for anyone, certainly a dog that's older. That one, I believe, was in cargo, not in the cabin. This is bad for United because a lot of people, every time one of these incidents happen, they seem to respond in this way that's really sort of robotic, doesn't seem very caring, seems kind of concerned about the incident, and it's just never there. Is there anything you really can say to make up for the death of a pet? I'm not sure, but certainly they need to get better with their crisis management because this isn't going away, and it's really alienating a lot of people. Will people fly again, United? Sure, some will, but if you have a pet that you want to bring on board, I've got to think you're thinking twice about this.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
We'll be on a happier note next time.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm so sad about this. It's here
and
now.
So am I.
Well, on today's DJ session, we are going to focus on Spanish Psy Trance. Oscar Esteban is DJ and host of The Raving Caveman on Barcelona City FM. That's an English language radio station based in Barcelona, Spain. Oscar, welcome to Here and Now.
Hello.
And first of all, Psy Trance means what?
Psy Trance is short for psychedelic trance, and it's a branch of trance that evolved from a region of India called Goa. Mm-hmm. And in Goa in the early 90s, late 80s, there used to be full moon rituals, like this kind of psychedelic gathering and party. And they started mixing the psychedelic rock sounds from the hippie community that was there and started mixing it with the electronic music that was coming from the UK mainly. And so Goa Trance was born.
Okay, well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is Recreate. It's by Own Trip. So what do you like about this song?
I chose this one because Own Trip is one of the main artists here in Catalonia, especially because he runs the label Own Spirit, which also sets up one of the biggest festivals in Spain, which is Own Spirit. And this is from his latest EP, and it's a really nice track.
And what should we know about him?
Well, basically that he's one of the main promoters here in in Catalonia. He is a stylist, really progressive and kind of spiritual, not because some progressive trends is like dirtier, but this is like really clean and old school.
Okay, next we have Lupin. This is the song Boom Shakalaka. So, do you have to be in a certain state of mind, if you will, to get the full enjoyment out of this music?
Maybe. I don't really need anything else but the music to fully enjoy it, but for a lot of people, it kind of really can be like that, yes. Hmm.
And who is Lupin?
Lupin is Miguel Solans. He's an artist from Barcelona. And I chose this track because it's from an album called Ritmo Galactico, and it's one of those tracks that when a DJ plays it, I just go completely nuts.
And are there moments in it when if you're DJing a big party that everybody gets most excited?
It's hard to explain with words, but one of the things I enjoy the most in the psytrance scene is that it's kind of different than techno parties. You can see all the people like smiling to each other, and it's kind of a big family. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get to the next song that you brought us. This is called Round 2. It's by Frequency Less. Now, people may be surprised to hear that Frequency Less is the musical project of Ricky Casero, who was born into a family of classical musicians. I don't know if I hear that influence there, but yeah, you tell us about this one.
Frequency Less is a really interesting artist because, as you said, he started making classical music, but he also produces Cybreaks, which is a mix between psychedelic trends and breakbeat. It's hard to classify his stuff, but he's really, really good.
One of the things that I notice about these kinds of songs, and we're only just playing a little bit of each of them, is that they tend to be pretty long, right?
Yeah, it's just a repetitive beat. It's kind of a kick and bass all the time, and that listening to that for a lot of time puts you in a trance, and it's kind of layered so that the kick and bass create a kind of hypnosis, and then the top layers are what really make you like trip.
Okay, well, we have time for one more. This is Green Poison by Green Beats. When you look at our current Western culture, what? Can you tell us what she's saying there?
Sorry, I wasn't really paying attention, but most of the boy samples from this kind of tracks are people talking about psychedelics or voice clips from Terence McKenna or Alan Watts or this kind of people.
Hmm. And in this case, it's Green Beats, which was formed by Victor Solsona and Xavier Danzana in 2008 in the Catalonian mountains. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, they are like the grandfathers of psytrance here in Catalonia. They've been playing Goa for many, many years, I would say even decades. I am actually a producer as well, and I really look up to what they do because I produce this sort of music. It's down-tempo, ambient, chill-out, that sort of stuff.
So usually on our show, when we're talking about Catalonia, about Barcelona, where you are, we're talking these days about politics and the referendum, the independence referendum in Catalonia. Has any of that politics made it into the music coming out of Barcelona?
Not that I know of, but it would be really funny to hear, like, put them on in a psytrance track. I really should look into doing that.
Oscar, I was just there recently in Barcelona, and I remember these big signs everywhere that said "Tourists go home." A lot of anti-tourist sentiment around, and I imagine that a lot of these tourists who are coming in are going to these trance parties.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's really common to go to a club, and I remember, for instance, one time I went to a psychedelic party that was in Pobla Español. And I remember that every bench had, like, people from different countries. There was one where Romanian people were sitting, one with German people, UK people. Psychedelic parties are a really great place to meet new people and learn about different countries, different cultures. It's really interesting.
Let's ask our Esteban, who is DJ and host of The Raving Caveman on Barcelona City FM. Oscar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we want more now on British Prime Minister Theresa May's announcement to Parliament today that 23 Russian diplomats will be expelled from the UK. Her response to Russia ignoring her deadline for an explanation of how Russian-produced nerve agents almost killed a former Russian spy and his daughter in the English town of Salisbury. Here's May today on the exiting diplomats.
This will be the single biggest expulsion for over 30 years. And it reflects the fact that this is not the first time that the Russian state has acted against our country.
A spokesman for Russian President Putin says Russia rejects the language of ultimatums and the accusations are false. But later today, the UN Security Council is meeting to be briefed on the attack. The BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera is here. Gordon, this is reading more and more like a novel, but it's true. What more do we know about these expelled Russian diplomats? Are they thought to be spies?
That's right. That's what the Prime Minister was indicating, saying that they were undeclared intelligence officers. So it's quite interesting that 23 was the figure she used. As far as we can tell from what's called the diplomatic list, there are only 58 diplomats in London linked to accredited to the Russian embassy. So 23 out of 58 being spies, according to the British, is about 40%. So pretty high proportion. And it would suggest that they're getting rid of most of them. There have actually been some bigger spy expulsions, but often when the then Soviet embassy was much larger. So this is actually a pretty high proportion of the embassy.
Well, she also cancelled all high level bilateral contacts with Russia, asked the royal family not to go to the Soccer World Cup in Russia. But you're pointing to something else, which is there seems to be an awful lot of spies, Russian spies and ex-Russian spies in London in the first place. Remind us about Sergei Skripal. He was the Russian agent convicted in Russia of giving identities of other Russian agents to Britain, jailed there, then released in a prisoner swap. That's why he was in Britain. It does seem as if there are so many Russian ex-spies or at least critics of Putin in Britain.
Well, I think that's true that there's long been a kind of intelligence battle between the UK and Russia. I mean, even before there was between the US and Russia, it goes back a good 100 years or so to the Russian Revolution. But then you also have another category of critics of Vladimir Putin. And again, London has often been a home for critics of other regimes, and in many cases going back hundreds of years with different countries. But certainly a lot of critics of Vladimir Putin have come here, most famously Boris Berezovsky, who was a Russian billionaire exiled, of having once been a close aide of Vladimir Putin. Working with him at a time was Alexander Litvinenko, who in turn was poisoned by radioactive polonium in 2006.
Well, we remember that slow, painful death, which was, you know, partly carried out on television. It was awful. But you mentioned Berezovsky. Monday night, another Russian exile was found dead in his home in London. And he was also a friend of the late Berezovsky. Just briefly, what do we know about the death of Nikolai Glushkov?
It's being investigated by the police as an unexplained death at the moment. Now, so far, there is no confirmation that it is suspicious he could have died of natural causes. But it's the fact he was a friend of Berezovsky which has led it to being investigated by the Counterterrorism Command, who deal with sensitive national security investigations. So I think you get a sense there that now, when well-connected Russians who are critics of Vladimir Putin die in Britain, it's being seen in a different light, and it may end up being nothing, yeah. But certainly it's being investigated much more thoroughly than you might have expected a few years ago.
Well, back to Sergei Skripal and his daughter, who had just arrived from Moscow to visit him when both were found slumped near the restaurant where they'd eaten, both now in critical but stable condition, and both found to have this nerve agent, Novichok.
Novichok, yeah.
When it sent other people to the hospital as well?
There's one police officer who is who has been taken ill, who treated them, who was one of the first responders at the scene. And he has been ill, not quite as seriously ill, though, as the others. But he's certainly ill. And that's a cause for a lot of concern and anger, because obviously he was not a target of this operation. But I think it is that idea that a nerve agent has been used on European soil for what appears to be the first time since the Second World War, which has led to this desire from Britain to really have a tough, robust response.
Well, in fact, when May spoke today, she said, this is, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of its use here in London, but it's about Russia's use of a chemical weapon more broadly. What is she implying here? We know that, for instance, Syria, Russia's ally, is using chemical weapons. What's she saying?
I think she's really talking about trying to put this incident that's happened in the last week or so in the broader context of Russian activity. And I think what she's trying to do is say this is not an isolated incident, less to do with chemical weapons and more to do with cyber attacks, other forms of intelligence activity, and to say it's not just us in the UK that are being hit, but this is happening in lots of places. And therefore, we as allies should stand together against Russia. So it's really an attempt to draw together international allies rather than just make it about this one incident, I think.
Of course, this is at a time when the US White House has not denounced Russia.
And I think that's been the subject of a lot of interest here is Rex Tillerson's comments, which were stronger than President Trump's comments. And then the next day, Rex Tillerson was gone. I mean, who knows if there's a link, but everyone is looking very closely at the comments that come out of Washington to see how much backing London gets from there.
The BBC security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.